You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Thank you, everybody, and thank you very much for inviting me to come up.
Thank you.
I have only about 300 or 400 slides to go through. It shouldn't take too long. But I don't want this really to be a, I would prefer it to be a discussion, obviously. So at any point, you can stop me and we can jump. But I think what I want to just do is sort of frame the discussion. There's lots of ways you can talk about open source hardware. I actually like talking about it in terms of communities, because if you look at open source software, I think all the power and benefit of that movement has come from sort of the bottoms up, community-based innovation. And we are certainly, I think, trying our best to foster that in a new area, which would be hardware. We call this the long tail of gadgets, just by virtue of the fact that we're looking for ways for people to remember what we're talking about. But what it really just means is that, you know, I think we as a consuming public have gotten used to this idea that devices come from big companies, right? The Saint Jobs, the Saint Stringers of the world, whom which we pray to for our devices, have always been the guys that give us the things that we know and love, the cell phones, the LCD televisions, and so on. But it's not written on some stone tablet that it has to be that way. And I think one of the things that I've found most interesting over the past 2.5 years since we've gotten started is how many people really are frustrated by this current set of affairs, because they've wanted to build devices either for themselves, they've wanted to build devices for a particular market niche, but the problem is that getting funding for those types of devices is very complicated, because the first thing that happens, and you can take my word for this, is if you come up with a great idea for a gadget and you go and talk to a VC, the first question they ask is, how big is the target market for this? How many are you going to sell? How many can you possibly sell? And the problem with that answer for a lot of these sort of gadgets which exist down here is that not that many. And maybe it's in the thousands, you know, maybe it's in the hundreds of thousands. It's just not a great investment given the economics today in electronics. So I started the company because I was sort of in the first bucket, which is I individually just wanted devices that didn't exist. The first thing I wanted actually came to me at the month after 9/11, and I live in Manhattan. My wife and I just have our first child, so he was about a month old, and everyone in Manhattan at the time was worried about a second attack. Everyone thought that 9/11 was just the beginning of just a series of just horrible attacks. So we all spent time on the cell phone calling one another, saying, hey, where are you? Where are you going to be? If we have to rendezvous, how am I going to find you, et cetera. So you can imagine 7 million people doing that all day. The networks were always bogged down. It was impossible to get calls through. And I said, well, there has to be a better way. I mean, maybe I can just build a device, which is a little GPS and a wireless modem, and every 5 minutes or so, it would just wake up and put its position on a map that I could just go to in a browser and see where my wife and child were. And I also said, well, you know, that device has to exist. It's such an obvious little thing. I mean, come on, they must have built that already. So I went and looked around. Sure enough, there wasn't that device. In fact, there really still isn't that device. So, you know, I grew up with Heathkits. I'm going to date myself, but how many people here remember Heathkits? Okay, so I know how old you guys are. And so Heathkits were this wonderful set of kits that you could actually build things. You could build televisions and stereos and all kinds of fun stuff. I said, you know, I'm pretty good with the soldering iron, so maybe I'll just go and build one of these things, right? Not. It became very evident very quickly that innovating at that level in hardware today is hard because the chips are this big, everything is little tiny little. It's kind of like trying to hack your car today. You can't really do that anymore either because it's basically a computer with wheels. So I got frustrated. I said, well, you know, data point. At the time, I was working on something else. But I had a series of these events where I said, you know, I really want devices that I couldn't find at Radio Shack or Best Buy, what have you. And so, you know, my device was probably way down here, you know, total market of 2. But I still would have bought it. I still, if someone had come to market with that device, I would have spent good money on it. So there are lots and lots of opportunities, I believe, in markets that are currently either underserved or not served at all. This is another thing which I put up at another conference which got a laugh, which is I'm from New York. We like to think of things in terms of pizza. But, you know, one of the ways of thinking about this is that, you know, all the things we know and love are these pepperonis. But there's this, all this other area where it's the cheese or the there are areas for opportunity. You know, another thing about economics, especially in the consumer electronics space today, is that it is a terrible business. Anybody who, I don't know if anybody here is in the business or knows it or advises the business, but it is a crap business. I'm sorry, it really is. It's a business of this type of thing, right? Over time, and it's just getting worse, right? So you spend millions of dollars on a device, and the idea is you want to sell lots fast, right? Because you've got to make back your investment. The problem has come now is that because innovation is happening so quickly, I call this the Ed Zander problem, which is you could have the world's best-selling cell phone 1 year and then be out of the job the next year because you haven't built the next hit. Right? This whole hit-based model is extremely expensive for everybody. It's expensive for the producers because you get a lot of smart people like you guys in a room who are like, okay, what's the next killer app? What's the next killer device? Nobody knows. Right? Apple has done a fantastic job. But the chances of them keeping it up at that pace, I think, are very slim. The fact of the matter is that it's hard, and even if you do have a hit, it doesn't last very long. Right? You've got to keep coming up with the hits. Add in the fact that China and all the Far East is getting into this market in a way that they haven't before. It's driving the margins out of the business, and it's just becoming an area where it's almost impossible to make money. So if you have an idea for a device, you're going to go pitch to a VC or whomever. You have to face these facts. VCs know these facts. And if you look at the amount of investment that's gone into hardware over the past few years, it has gone also down.
Right.
And it's because this just doesn't make sense. But what if we could change the basis of innovation? What if we could do in hardware what we've been doing in software for the past 10, 20 years? Make it so that any business could build devices easily. Consumers themselves could actually put things together, like myself, what I want to do. Wouldn't that be interesting? Let communities innovate around specific requirements. And specifically, it would be, how do we get hardware to act less like hardware and more like software? Now, that's a kind of a strange thing to say, but I think there are opportunities here where we can, if you can sort of envision a world where the marginal cost of hardware is going down, all the value is in software.
Right.
We all have cell phones. Any computer in this world, probably in this building, have a lot of similar components. They got CPUs, memory, I/O. It's just different, lots of different proprietary packagings.
Right.
So if you can sort of make a way of getting that simplified, lower the barriers to innovation, make the transaction costs trend towards zero, then my feeling is that you get a lot of interesting things happening. So not to belabor the point, but here's the idea. If you look at software today, I can graduate from Harvard with a great idea for a website. And I can very quickly just avail myself to all this open source software. I can go and get Apache or something called the LAMP stack, which is Linux, Apache, MySQL, and PHP. And I could build my website for very little investment. In fact, one of the things that's driving VCs crazy right now is that you can start a company that's worth $1 billion in 5 years and only raise $1,000 to do it.
Right?
That doesn't make VCs happy because they don't understand how they can invest in that world. And so I can go and avail myself to all this free stuff. There's this thing called a platform that already exists, which is the operating system on these devices, which basically abstracts a lot of the hardware complexity away. And so I can very quickly go and create a business, either a website, software, what have you. Hardware, I don't know if any of you have been in the hardware world before, but it's a completely different world. If I have an idea for a gadget, I suddenly have to understand electronics. I have to be very good at not just electronic design. I have to go deal with suppliers. BOM stands for bill of materials. I have to then produce Gerber files that manufacturers will use to create the boards. I've got to become a mechanical engineer. So there's no one easy answer here. And to make matters worse, you have now to deal with things like this, right? Manufacturing inventory, supply chain stuff, which is a very, very thorny issue. Things that you don't have to worry about with software. My feeling is that there's a way of bringing together some of the things we've learned in software. So you have open source IP in much the same way as you have software. So this could be everything from board designs to even down as far as chip designs and so on. Generally available IP that's community-based, people can use, low cost. You then have a hardware platform that helps to do this, abstract away a lot of the things that were earlier complicated. Unlike software, I think this is a necessary requirement because hardware, it's atoms, it's not bits. You can't send hardware over the internet. So you need physical pieces and parts to help you get there. And luckily, there's actually an example of this. Lego Mindstorms, if you guys are familiar with Mindstorms, it's a robotics kit. Now, Lego, I think, has done an absolutely brilliant job with this lately, where they've gone to the community and they've said, you know, we're not only going to give you the pieces and parts, but we're going to open source it. Right? So they've basically done what I said earlier, which is, if you want to create something which they don't have, you have open source pieces and parts. Right? They have a platform. In this case, the platform is what we know and love, which is the Lego physical interface. Right? You plug things in. It's very easy to understand. It's intuitive. You can watch any 3-year-old work with that interface. And even now, my 7-year-old doesn't stop playing with it. Actually, I like playing with it. But the point is that they have a platform. And now they also have given you this, which is Lego Factory. So if you want to actually build your own pieces, you just submit the plans, they'll build it for you. They haven't gone so far as to say they'll sell it for you. Maybe they have, actually, I don't know. Actually, maybe I think they have. But the point is that this is a good example of a platform approach to hardware innovation. And by the way, I'll talk about this later, but that's what we're doing. Bug Labs has sort of a similar approach with electronics, which is a set platform that includes hardware pieces and parts, software and web services and so on, that allows you flexibility to build things. But if we can get there, my feeling is that we can start to explore the long tail of gadgets in a way that's economic, right? So you can take advantage of the fact that this platform is now being invested in and scaled across multiple verticals, right? Multiple small verticals. So instead of having to make a bet that I'm going to come up with a medical device, I'm going to sell 100,000 of those, and I'm going to have to amortize the cost of that over that market, I can say I'm going to take advantage of a platform that maybe is talking to 100 different verticals of the same size, bringing the manufacturing costs down that way. And so again, things we talked about already, which is this notion that bottoms-up experimentation, bottoms-up innovation is a great way to get where we want to go. You know, following Obama, Umair Haque wrote who works also at Harvard, had a great blog post comparing McCain's election campaign organization to Obama's. And I think it was a terrific metaphor, because what he was saying how is that, you know, McCain had a very much a command and control type of architecture, which is, you know, everyone did according to the plan. And Obama's was much more of a community-based, bottoms-up type of approach. And the bottoms-up approach in this case was helpful, because if you look at what happened to McCain when the financial shock hit, is he said, hold it, I'm going to stop my campaign, I'm going to go to Washington. So the entire organization kind of stopped and was looking up the hierarchy and saying, okay, what do I do now? Whereas Obama, he basically, well, I guess the next week, he raised more money than he'd ever raised, because his organization was loosely coupled and they all had their marching orders and they went and did what they're supposed to do. I think the same thing is true here. We are looking now for, you know, Sony and Apple and these guys to tell us the features that we want, telling us the pieces and parts that we could expect to get. But the fact of the matter is that we all know what we want. I think I was just in a meeting with a guy just here talking about medical, talking about healthcare. And the interest in the communities around healthcare, whether it be for people who are older, people with specific conditions, people who, you name it, these are all very specific communities. They all have very specific needs. Apple, Medtronic, these guys are not going to somehow come up with the grand solution for all these things. It's going to have to be a bottoms-up approach. It's the only way they can scale. So my feeling is that this type of approach to that kind of problem, I think, is critical. Lastly, my feeling is that there's also a business here, right? It's not necessarily just a project which is purely altruistic. It's that companies like mine and others can actually make money while doing the same, while pursuing the same goals. And there's one more thing. This is something to think about, because, you know, the future is connected. One of the things we talk about is this idea of social network of gadgets. You know, Facebook is this idea where people now are socially networking and sharing things, but in the future you're going to have our devices sharing information among each other. And one of the things that we're finding is an enormous amount of interest from folks who don't normally innovate in hardware, but have different plans, but now getting interested in innovating in hardware, which is this idea that internet traffic, for the most part, has been driven by computers, and now mobile phones, things like iPhones getting on. But now you have wireless networks saying, okay, well, like in Europe, they have 110% penetration of cell phones. They're not going to sell a lot more cell phones. So if you're in the business of selling 3G data connectivity, what you're interested in now is getting more and more devices onto your network. The question is, where are those devices going to come from? Historically, they've had to wait for guys like Nokia, Sony Ericsson, Motorola to come up with these devices for them. But they realize that that market doesn't scale, because that's not going to get them where they want to go, which is lots and lots of devices on this sort of social network of gadgets vision. And so again, my feeling is that in order to achieve this, the only way that's going to happen is with entrepreneurs and others finding new ways of innovating in a cost-effective way to create these new types of devices. And so we're in talks with lots of carriers about lots of different ideas that they have. But it's going to be a world, like 10 years from now, I think it's going to be a completely different world in terms of how devices come to market. You could be buying devices from carriers themselves. You could be buying devices from individuals. So it's going to be interesting. Bug Labs, just real quickly, we create a platform that allows you to sort of mix and match things like Legos. We have sort of the three pieces of this, which is the hardware itself, integrated development environment, and then the community where you can share things. But my feeling is that a bottoms-up approach to consumer electronics based on open source principles is going to happen. I think it's going to happen not just in electronics, it's going to happen in lots of other physical goods. Today, for example, there are open source shoe manufacturers, there are open source apparel manufacturers. You can go to like Mini Cooper's website and design your own car, you can go to Nike and design your own sneakers. There's going to be a lot of interest in this notion of giving control to customers and letting them do what they want to do. And, if you look at this whole notion of personalization, this extreme level of personalization, everyone's got their own website, everyone's got their own Facebook page. It's not inconceivable that someday down in the future that people are going to want to have very highly personalized physical things as well. I don't think it's going to happen from a Sony or from an Apple coming up with it. It's going to happen from a more bottom-up approach. So that's it. I didn't want to spend too much time doing the presentation. I'd much rather have a conversation about some of these things. So that's it. Yes?
How do you make money? What's the business model?
It's actually it's a business model which you may have heard of. It's selling things to people.
So you sell the kits.
Yeah. That's why I'm not trying to make fun of that model. It's just VCs typically now are interested in Web 2.0. And when we were actually going and talking to them and saying, so our business model is actually selling atoms. They're like, wait a minute, I've never heard of that before. Yeah, so we build things and sell them. That is our business model currently. But how it works in an IT standpoint, an open source IT standpoint, IP standpoint, is over time, our hope is that people create lots of different types of gadgets using our open source IP. And we can participate at a services level with those types of I'll give you an example. Talking to a company right now who has an idea for remote healthcare monitoring. The idea for them is they want to create a little internet gateway, constellation of services that are based on monitors in the home. But the devices themselves are running Linux. And it's a fairly sophisticated version of Linux. And this particular company has no interest in becoming experts in Linux. And so our model then starts looking like Red Hat. So you've got 20,000 devices on the network. They need to be maintained in terms of getting them up to speed. Are up to date with respect to the latest versions of Linux, security performance patches, and so on. We have a model which is a couple dollars a month per device, and that's what we do. We keep them up to speed. So it's very much like Red Hat. In fact, Bob Young, who's the founder of Red Hat, is an investor in the company. Yeah.
So I'm really interested in this analogy between how software is built nowadays and how you'd like to see hardware being built. Because software is actually built a bunch of different ways.
Sure.
And the way that you're describing around the LAMP stack, which a lot of people in this room have experience with, works really, really well for social software that lots of people use, where the interesting behavior comes out of multiple usage for it. There's another model of software design, which is game design, right? Which is extremely difficult to get into, extremely difficult for sole practitioners to get into, often requires the same upfront investment as a Hollywood film.
Sure.
I guess one of my questions is, how do we know that gadget design, consumer electronics design, is more analogous to the sort of LAMP-style server software and less analogous to the sort of intensive game design? And let me add sort of one thing to that, sure. which is as much as I'm a proponent of open source software and use as much of it as I can, one of the consistent weaknesses of the open source community is interface design, which tends to be years behind what consumer interface design is. Isn't consumer electronics mostly an interface problem as well as an execution problem?
Yeah, okay, so these are all good points. I guess where I would start is, what I'm proposing is not a winner-takes-all type of deal. There are going to be plenty of ways to innovate. What I'm suggesting, though, is that right now, if you're somebody who wants to innovate in hardware, there's no choice. The only choice you have is the consumer electronics model, right? I'll give you an analogy. I went to CES for the first time 3 years ago, and I walked in. I don't know if anyone has been there, but it's this giant affair. And they had, at that time, they had just opened this new robotics pavilion. And I walk in, and the device I saw was this beautiful $3,000 little aluminum robot, Korean made, which was literally doing Tai Chi. Like, it was sitting there, it was, you know, doing this, and stand on its head, it would roll, it would do this, all this unbelievable balance. I just could not believe it. $3,000 to get you that. The very next table was Lego Mindstorms. Okay. Now, Lego, we all know what Lego looks like. It looked nothing like that thing. But at that point, because I was concerned about this too, I said, so am I barking up the wrong tree here? Because I don't want to, I can't really compete with an iPhone, right? So looking at this, I said, you know what? It seems fairly obvious that these two vendors do not compete, because the Lego robot was like opening a jar of peanut butter or something. And he said, well, you know, it can do that today, and it can be your mobile vacuum cleaner tomorrow. But trying to get that nice Korean robot to do anything different than what it was designed for, you'd have to take out your welding torch and really just go at it, right? Very different ideas. So the Korean robot is like the iPhone. Its design, its feature set was designed by somebody else. You like it, you don't like it, you buy it. If it doesn't do what you want, you just live with it. Versus a Lego, right? And so they are not, Lego's not trying to say it's a better way of creating a robot. They're saying it's just another way. And so Lego, you know, is not selling as many as iPhone is. Sure, I mean, they're selling, I don't know, a few hundred thousand kits a year, which is a great business. But they also haven't taken the next step, which I wouldn't be surprised if they do, which is sort of trying to get farther down the chain from toys to actual working things. And that's really all I'm saying. You know, there are certain things that it will work for. There are absolutely things it will not work for.
I actually have a great deal of confidence in your business. I actually think your business, in looking at the same space as sort of the Mindstorm space, and essentially saying it would be great to have a Heathkit that allowed us to build stuff that we'd actually care about today. I think that's really smart and a great place to go. What I guess I'm questioning is this sort of larger model of whether the ideas that come out of that space are going to filter up.
Yeah.
I wonder if to sort of, I mean, I guess my concern is to get a device into people's hands where thousands or hundreds or thousands are using it, eventually you're going to run into the same sort of supply chain problems, the same sort of the incredible complexity of that whole process in building a consumer device. Any thoughts of, I mean, you're doing, and I'm sorry, I don't mean this to be like harsh critique, but you're clearly doing really great work on the design phase of this and sort of getting people to experiment with this.
Yep.
But it seems like to sort of bring about the revolution that you'd like to have happen, you would need there to be a manufacturing revolution as well. You would need there to be a pretty massive process revolution.
Well, there's no doubt. And just to be clear, I'm not suggesting that we are the revolution. You know, I think one of the things that I think is happening is there's this wave, right? So it's probably been happening for the past 10 years, which is this notion that control really is moving from the producers of things to the consumers of things. You've seen it specifically in the digital side. TiVo is a great example, right? So now I could watch that whenever I wanted to. I could go watch Obama's inauguration when I go home. I don't have to see it live, right? In fact, when we go on vacation right now, my son and my daughter were watching television. I forget where we were. It wasn't TiVo or what have you. And I said, okay, guys, we've got to go. And they're like, well, can you just pause that show? I'm like, no, I can't pause that show. What do you mean you can't pause the show? Well, because these guys are called the network broadcasters. Won't let, you know, the notion of him not having control over his content just makes no sense to him. He is in control of what he has. And so our feeling of that the products, physical products, come from somebody else, and over those things we have absolutely no control over, I think will be a foreign concept in some generation in the future. So we're not saying we're going to cause that. All we're trying to say is this is our little surfboard, and we're going to try to get on this wave. And so for us, if we can make a good living just sort of demonstrating sort of the power of this, and find ourselves in positions where we are invited to help get things to market. You know, we're not going to, you're right, but like guys like Neil Gershenfeld and others at MIT who have this notion of 3D printing, I don't know if you guys have played with that. This is probably 10 or 20 years away. But right now, people are coming to us and saying, you know what, I'd really love to have a case that's shiny red. We're like, no problem. We'll just print it. Like, we're not going to go and make a mold and have it made in China. We're going to print it for you. We'll have it in a week. Now, there's some trade-offs, but the idea is that you can get physical things in quantities of one for not a lot of money today. It's not so far to think you're going to get something specifically what you want in a much higher quality 10 years from now. So these are all things that are contributing, right? So there is going to have to be a manufacturing revolution. It's going to have to get a lot easier. But I don't think it's inconceivable that would happen. Yeah.
I'm interested in the leadership question, like in practice, and how much that would be something that Bug Labs would be interested, or how do you envisage that? So, for example, in the case of our project, there's potentially 1 billion people who can walk to the internet but don't have it at home.
Yeah.
So this idea to say, hey, instead of me paying $1 an hour at an internet cafe and walking 3 miles, why don't I have an offline device? Why don't I be able to just plug in my flash drive? Why can't I plug in a standard keyboard?
Sure.
Maybe it's a little box. Maybe I can plug in any display I can afford.
Yeah.
Maybe I can use standard mobile phone rechargeable batteries and take
sure.
a module. And then maybe I can plug in other things like a Wi-Fi thing or an audio thing or a
yeah.
video thing, etc. So there's a real possibility for a modular approach. And there's real advantages to Africans being in control electronically, to where they could learn electronics hardware skills as they do this. And it's even, it could even cost a lot. So if it could be done, let's say, for low power, for $500, because the users are getting the equivalent of a college education, because they're available
right.
for paid work, because the device doesn't have to be cheap.
Yep.
But in principle, and we don't even have to make money from it. Like, we'd like to see it expanded and used. But the one thing we would like is to be able to have the leadership to where, as the device develops, we're able to keep it as open as much as possible. So
sure.
proprietary companies can participate, but there's some kind of standard, some kind of formats
yep.
that encourage this modularity. And so we'd like to see it grow, like let the initial devices be $500, but then at a certain point to be able to make 100 of them, or
yeah,
1,000
sure.
of them, or 10,000. And so the question is, how does the leadership, how do you envisage like the leadership working in that way?
Bug's leadership?
Well, or any leadership, like how do, you know, who...
I'll give you an
Who
example.
Shows the leadership in that
we're
example?
Doing, we're doing two things in Africa right now, actually.
Mm-hmm.
We're working with a group called the Grameen Foundation,
mm-hmm.
which has two schools. One's in Uganda, the other's in Rwanda. And I don't know if you guys know Grameen. Grameen, he actually won a... The guy who started it was a guy named Muhammad Yunus. And he started by doing micro-lending in Bangladesh, predominantly to women. And so... I won't go into the whole history of that, but one of the big successes they had was this thing called, it was like the cell phone woman. And so the idea was that you'd give this woman a cell phone, and other villagers would come and use it as like her, she was like a payphone. So they would give her a penny or a nickel, whatever they could afford, to talk for a certain number of minutes on the cell phone. That was her business.
Right.
And they did this to remarkable success around the Far East. They're now trying to duplicate that in Africa. But to your point, one of the things that they're now trying to say is, look, what other types of technologies could we enable people with? They're not trying to figure it out themselves. So what they've done, the University of Uganda, and I forget the name of the school in Rwanda, but they've taken some of our hardware, they basically just tossed it out there and said, okay, so what business models can we wrap around hardware that they come up with, not something we come up with? And some of the things that are coming out of that are remarkable. But for us as leaders, I don't think, we can't really stand in the way of that. The only thing we're saying is, we tell them when new modules come out. Like, we just announced 5 new modules. One's an audio one, one's a 3G, one's a thing called Levon Hipple, which allows you to make your own. We just sort of give them those. And we offer them a place for them to share. So it's like a free website for them to share all the stuff they're doing. So that's one example. I think that it's not so much leadership, it's just participation and sort of being at the table. The other one is this in Kenya, there's this thing called Barcamp. There's one in Nairobi. And that's a fascinating example of like 100 or 200 sort of Kenyan geeks basically coming together and just coming with cool ideas. And one of the fun ideas that we talked about was, that I've talked about publicly, is and one that I probably wouldn't have come up with myself, which was the pothole identifier. Right, so they take a bug, put an accelerometer and a GPS in it, and they put it in the car. And what happens is, as they're driving down the road, and apparently in Kenya off-road, there's all kinds of horrible potholes, like man-eating truck-eating poppies. And you don't always see them before it's too late, because there's no light. So you run in and all of a sudden, oh no! So the accelerometer keeps track of the bumps, okay, and posts them on the map. And as other people come through and mark them, then the map says, okay, it starts developing a crowdsourced version of where the problems are on the road. Right? This is a problem in Kenya. It's also a problem in New York City, but we have other assets there. But so they came up with this as their own, and I thought that was fascinating. It's something I would have done, but they came up with it, they shared it, and so on. But this is a good example. Now, I obviously you're much more expert than I am in how Africa works, but we're not trying to become, we're not trying to tell them the right thing to do. All we're trying to do is give them the facilities and the infrastructure to do what they want.
So like in our case, there's not this distinction between them and us. Like, we're working as equals. We meet each other halfway.
Right.
As an example of what we did, we organized 100 peacemakers on the ground and 100 online during the Kenya post-election turmoil, like,
yep,
to stop genocide. So there's a need to show leadership, to include people, and to kind of... So in the way we would approach something like this, we're looking at... We don't have the kinds of resources of one laptop per child. So
right,
we look, what can you do for $100? So for $100, you can... we're having this project where... You take flash drives, you have 12 locations, you have a central location, you do a mail service.
Yep.
So it's a $100 project.
Yep.
And so that's one step further. Yep. And then, but somebody has to keep kind of like gluing together, like someone has to take leadership,
yep,
to make that happen. It doesn't happen without any leadership.
Sure.
And so, but you're not going to provide that leadership. So,
no.
But for the open source hardware community to be successful, I think that's key.
Yeah, it is key, but I think one of the things that we've learned is that leadership has to emerge.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make yourself the leader. You may be able to make yourself, you can sort of say, hey, we're going to throw a party and see who comes, but who's going to run the party can't necessarily always be you. That's a hard thing for me to learn, actually, because my whole background is in enterprise software, right? Where it's, everything's proprietary, everything's a licensing model, and so you're in complete control. But in this case, you have to get comfortable with this idea of just sort of saying, here it is, and see what happens. And sometimes nothing happens, which just sort of hurts your feelings. And then sometimes surprising things happen. But the fact of the matter is, at least as far as I can tell, our best contributors have just shown up. We haven't gone and tried to find them. We haven't said, here's $1,000 for anybody who comes and does that. It's just they have just shown up. They like what we're doing. And here they come up with unbelievable work. And I think they become, and so what happens is that one person starts to become a lightning rod for others. They go to them and they say, hey, how do I do this? How do I do that? And it turns out, hey, that guy doesn't even work for the company. They start, just like any other grouping of humans, leadership sort of sort themselves out. But we kind of sort of try to get the fire started, and that's kind of the mode we're in right now. It's hard to be the leader of a ground up type of, I think. Yeah.
And here in the United States, at least, wireless carriers have, for the most part, been pretty resistant to the idea of,
yep,
letting devices that they can't control onto their network.
Yep.
Do you see that as, being a problem for your model? Will the attitudes of these companies change, or will overcoming their resistance be one of the biggest problems you face?
I think two things. I think it's absolutely a problem. But if you look at Europe, I think we're going to have to start looking at that model. Because if you believe that graph I showed, which is as wireless carriers start to say, look, what we really want is to have more devices on our network, then, right now it's like a 3 or 4 month wait period to get certified. Right? That model can't last. In Europe, you can just throw a SIM card into anything and wham, you're on the network. For some reason, there's this control freak problem going on in the United States. So if they really want to have and participate in this growth of data, they're going to have to give up that. I think they realize that. Verizon has said publicly they have this program, which they announced basically in conjunction when Google came out with their Android spiel, when Google was pushing them for the FCC thing. And I think they're going to follow through on that. AT&T, T-Mobile, and so on, I think are going to get there. So I think pure economics are going to drive them. But it is a problem. I think right now we're getting much more interest in Europe for this kind of thing than we are in America. But I do think that simple economics are going to show them. Because, if you think about what they're trying to do, as everything moves to an IP-based network, right, they can identify, so if I put on a device that just suddenly starts spamming their network, right, they have network operators. They can say, okay, what's that? Just close it. Just shut it down. Just the same way I can put up a website today, right? No one's going to, my ISP is not going to have to make me certify my website. I can put up a website and start spamming everybody on the planet, and they'll shut it down. Network operators have the same level of control. So it's kind of a strange problem that they have. Yeah.
Just tell them some of the definition of what hardware is? And the reason why I mean that is, back in the Heathkit days, right? You could build a AM radio,
yep,
and it could be the size of a shoebox, but that's kind of what AM radios look like. So you as a builder were happy that it worked, and your family was happy because it worked like an AM radio.
Yep.
But today we're moving towards hardware that doesn't even allow you to replace batteries.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So if I were to build something, say, for my kids, you know, it better be an iPhone,
yep,
or something of that ilk.
Yep.
So how do you kind of get over that basic form factor? You know, again, something mentioned earlier, it's the UI issue, really.
Sure.
You know,
I don't know if you ever get over it, to be honest with you. I think it's really what you value. So, for example, if you really want an iPhone, you're going to buy an iPhone. Because, again, I'm not suggesting that integrated devices are going to go away. But I'm suggesting two things. One is there are moments when the modularity is more important than the aesthetics. So you need something which is really flexible. And so you may want to buy something which has that modularity built in. You trade off sort of the beauty of an integrated device. But that's okay, because the proposition was that I valued modularity over pure aesthetic. So number one, I think it goes back to my Lego Mindstorms analogy. But the other thing that happens, and one of the big markets that we're serving right now are prototypers, R&D divisions of companies. Because what's happened in the past is that, here, I'll give you an example. There's a company in New York, which was an architecture firm, and they suddenly found themselves doing things called, like place design or interaction design. And the example they had is that one of their big hotel clients had these big lobbies, and they wanted to have something special happen in the lobby. So you walk into the lobby, they wanted something happen, right? More than just today. So these guys devised a interactive screen that went across sort of an entrance to a hall. And the idea was that as people walked underneath it, right where they walked under, a shower of sparks would go flying up on these big LCD screens, right? So they came up with that prototype with the old soldering irons, duct tape, and so on, made it work, had to make it work. The demo went really well. The hotel chain said, that's great, we want 200. Okay, so now they're like, what? These are like the three geeks in the room. Like, we are not going to solder together 200 of these things. We're just not. Because, number one, we don't want to do it. Two, we don't want to support it. Three, it's a liability. They would catch on fire. And so they just didn't want to do it. So they had to say, but they couldn't go to a contract manufacturer and say, build us these, because the cost would have been low, right? So that's a perfect example of a customer of ours where they're saying, we're going to prototype it using your stuff. And then to move from prototype to product, there really is no, because the prototype is the product. There's no UI problem because this thing is just going to sit in some room somewhere, right? So 200. We're talking to others that want 1,000, 3,000. And the problem today is that how do you innovate? How do you come to market with a device that total market could be measured in the thousands? It's very hard. You're either literally soldering it together yourself, or you're having to go raise a lot of money and spend, you know, tons of dough. Yep.
I think that if your devices are a success, you'll also eventually see a class of companies emerge that are basically in the business of taking these things and turning them into packaged devices. You know, so when you reach some threshold, 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 or wherever the economic breaking point turns out to be, you would go to this company that's in the business of taking this modular design and turning it into a packaged product. And it would be much easier than the job of making a consumer electronic device is now, because they'd be starting from this, you know, fairly standardized framework.
And that's kind of the third leg of the stool, which is not something that we intend to own, right? So assuming you believe in open source, and assuming you want to participate in that world, the idea is that as these guys come up with their spiel, their business is not to own that proprietary thing. They say, okay, look, that IP goes back into the community. So now somebody else wants to say, oh, I want to do something similar. They now have access to that. They can share it. We are hopefully we'll get invited to the party and say, you know, we can help you make an integrated device using our architecture. Okay, it's in our best interest, because if we want to make money on this Red Hat model, I don't really care what hardware you're using. You kind of made in Korea for a third of the price that we could buy my stuff. But if it's running my stack, then that's good. I can do my Red Hat thing to you. But on the other hand, just in the pure open source, you know, community interest, the idea would just be that everybody now starts to benefit as this stuff happens, right? So people would pick and, you know, say, okay, this is a reference design that worked in that context. If I take it and tweak it just a little bit, it'll work in mine. The same thing happens with software today, then I think everyone benefits from that model.
How can you see encouraging that? Because as it is right now, there's lots of home electronics that have the Linux kernel running, most of the interface and things like that. And one of the big arguments is that large manufacturers like Sony, Hitachi, people like this, aren't necessarily contributing back into that community.
Sure.
And this then becomes this, closed off ecosystem at that point. Similar to like the iPhone, for example. There's lots of open source components to
in
it.
There, yeah.
But, it's a closed ecosystem.
Yeah, that's a good question. It goes back to the earlier, I don't think there's a way you can force it. You just have to say, look, you either want to participate in the community or you don't. But our notion is that there are no penalties, really. You can take it and not give back. But it's incumbent upon us to sort of show that the net benefit you get from sharing is higher than the net benefit from hoarding. And I think, most people would agree that if you look over the long term, closed systems work great in the short term because you can drive enormous amount of value. Apple, Bloomberg, BlackBerry, these all have these very proprietary stacks. But if you look at why PC eventually became the more favored platform over the Macintosh, it was because it had this open community. It's a little messy, it's chaotic, but it took a while to get there, right? So people like totally locked down solutions. In fact, I'll go back one farther. If you look at how the PC, the microcomputer, sprung to market, it was on the backdrop of the mini computer market. The mini computer market, for those of you who remember, was based on a model which is very similar to consumer electronics, which is you get the hardware, the software, the operating system, all from one vendor. Companies liked that fully integrated model because it was the one throat to choke model, which was, if there's any problem that you pick up a phone, you call an 800 number, IBM, I don't care if it's a hardware driver or a software driver, you just get over here and fix it. IBM did that, made a lot of money. They probably made too much money, right? And that was the problem, is that once they had you, they had you. I'll show you some images I use all the time. I got this in the mail the other day. This is a Samsung Touch. Sprint was sending this out. My wife picks it up. She says, oh, this is a nice device. Maybe I could use this. Hey, could I hook this up to iTunes? No. I, of course, snicker. Ha, ha, ha. No way. Because once iTunes got you, you can only use Apple hardware. And that's ridiculous. But people like it for reasons they like it. But that is so much. And so these guys are screwed. Because they don't have iTunes. They don't have the App Store. They don't have all these things that Apple brought to bear. And so they're just playing catch-up in the iPhone market. This is destined to fail. Right? So, but everyone likes it in the short term because it's totally integrated. Over the long term, I think people are beginning to question this now. What happens when Jobs is no longer at the helm and no longer has this maniacal devotion to closed proprietary architectures? What's going to happen to Apple? Right? Well, that you can say that about any consumer electronics device manufacturer. What happens when they stop coming up with the hits?
Sony.
Sony, Motorola. That's what happens to these companies. And it's not good for the shareholders. It's not good for the producers. It's not good for us because we're not getting what we want. So it's just, I just feel like that you're right. In the short term, it's hard because people want what they're used to. And people are used to business models that are based on proprietary lockdown. I'm going to close, you're going to do business with me, and once I got you, you're mine. But people are going to get sick of that, I think, over time.
Yeah. I was wondering what you thought about the Chumbi model, where you have like a pre-made device, but people are encouraged to hack it and develop content
for it. I mean, I think Chumbi, Steve Tomlin and I talk all the time. I think that model is totally in keeping with what we're talking about. And if you look, they announced this deal with Sony at CES, which is totally about content, right? It's all just a content player, which is where they want to go. Their whole notion is it's kind of what we're doing, which is they want to sort of show the way. Like, here's a device that can do blah. Now do it, make it what you want. I think it's absolutely in keeping with what we're talking about. There's a question, yeah.
These devices, like smartphones and other things that people carry with them, are starting to do more and more, and a lot of what you would do with customized device like the pothole detector you could do with software on these, do you still see a big market for custom devices? Or
well, I guess I get this question a lot. I think there's always going to be a set of applications which you can do with existing stuff, period, the end. But I'll give you an example. I'm talking to a game developer who has a game which she thinks could be very popular, which is about environmental awareness. Requires a GPS, a screen, I think an accelerometer or something like that, and a carbon monoxide detector. Okay, so let's see here. You think any of those device manufacturers are going to be coming out with a carbon monoxide detector in their phones anytime soon? The answer is no. So the question is, how does he, you know, how does he gives up, basically, because he's not going to duct tape a, you know, but he likes bug because he's like, oh, now I can snap those things on, boom, done, yeah? And I can say, I'm going to buy 100, and you and my friends, we're all going to play this game together. And so you can get a small investment to just see if it works. Hey, it works. Huge success. Now I can go to an investor and I can say, look at this, this is working. Then you get a little bit of investment. Then you say, okay, we don't want the modularity, we're going to make a more integrated device. But it's all based on this open source IP, so it's much cheaper to do, right? Make a little more progress. Suddenly it becomes, right? If you remember, the cell phone didn't used to have a camera. Everyone thought the camera would be a great idea. But it took 2 years to get from a great idea to actually being in a handset, only after it was demonstrated that people actually wanted it. But those experiments took millions and millions of dollars to get straightened out. So is this an example of there will always be the lowest common denominator things that people want that have been demonstrated. But there's always the things that, you know, so a great example of this, there's this little chip called an accelerometer, which we probably all heard of now, but 5 years ago, I'm sure no one would have heard of it. But it's a little chip that determines, that can register position in space, right? An application developer probably came up with this idea, which is that Nintendo, they said, you know, if we can marry our application with an accelerometer-based device, we could do some cool things, like you can maybe have play tennis or golf, right? And they basically revolutionized gaming. They literally revolutionized gaming on the back of a 5-cent sensor, which had been around for years, right? So the GPS is another sensor. Suddenly, everyone's interested in GPS. GPS has been around for 20 years. 20 years? 10 years, no, long time. But now everyone suddenly is, God, I want a GPS in my toaster. I mean, everyone wants it. But the fact of the matter is that these are sensors. These are pieces of I.O. that at one point were weird. Like, why? It doesn't make any sense. Suddenly now, right, you have applications. The question becomes, how do you, not me, or how does society inspire innovation in ways that benefits us all, easier and more cost-effective way? And so our idea is to sort of have this modular approach, which, you know, we want to come up with 100 different sensors, carbon monoxide detectors, pressure, vibration, atmospheric, anything, in the hopes that maybe, you know, as people are casting lines into the water, one is a strike. And it's not our job to figure out what that strike is. Right? So it's a long-winded answer to the question, which is, we can just sort of sit around as application developers and rely on the powers that be to give us hardware that we can then use, or we can sort of take control of it ourselves.
Yeah. As you know, the wind tunnel platforms continue to shrink,
yep,
as we get more and more stuff that's USB-enabled, Bluetooth-enabled, so on and so forth, doesn't that sort of solve the issue, or is it still missing something?
No, it could. It absolutely could. And, you know, again, my goal is not to own this market.
Yeah.
My goal is to provide something which doesn't exist right now, which is choice. And choice as it pertains to open source IP. You say Bluetooth, that's closed. You say Intel, that's closed. You say, you know, I'll go back to medical for a second. This whole notion of taking care of the elderly or pharmaceutical compliance and, you know, pill boxes that don't recognize what's in it and how many, those are all good. Those ideas have been around for a long time. But everybody has their own idea for it. Like, because their business model relies upon you buying my technology. That model is going to continue, of course. But I don't think, for these big thorny problems, I don't think that's the way you're going to find a good answer. It's going to be the sort of bottoms-up thing. So if the answer is a bunch of Bluetooth sensors and an atom-based box, that's fine. I don't really care. But my point is that we just need something more than just totally closed proprietary solutions. We need something which has no transaction costs, no licensing costs. So the business that we're doing today is for people who care about the fact that when they buy our stuff, they get all the source code for everything. They the schematics, the Gerber files, and so on. They never have to talk to us again. They can be like, okay, thank you very much. Hey, Flextronics, let's do it. Yep. And I think that's part of the ethos of what I'm talking about, which is absolutely there are lots of ways to skin this cat. But today, the only way to do it is with a model which has been around for a long time, which is a totally closed, proprietary, locked-in model, where my business model is contingent upon owning you as a customer. And I think sometimes it works, but I think less and less is going to be the way to go long term. What's it? Yeah.
So
I have significantly more money in Lego than I would in than the Tai Chi robot. And to bracket that, I would like to build a digital camera for my 4-year-old daughter. There are digital cameras for kids on the market.
Sure.
And they're all junk, but they cost, you know, $60, $50, $80.
Yep.
If I went to go and build one with some sort of fancy modular system, is it going to cost me $500? At which point I just say, oh, it's like the Lego. It's good for building, but it's not really good for making something that's an end product. I could just go and buy a Tai Chi robot. It might not do all the moves that I want, but it gets me 95% of the way, and I can just, you know, suck it up because I don't have really an extra $500 for a
sure.
toy camera.
Yeah.
When the consumer market thing is already getting me, you know, 90% of the way there, and if I, you know, lower down my geek pride a little bit and say, okay, really it's getting me 99.9% of the way there, I don't really need that last bit.
Sure.
That seems like a problem to the whole thing.
Yeah. When you try to compare something like this with existing categories, it doesn't really make any sense. I mean, if you really want a digital camera, I mean, heck, you can go open a bank account and get one for free. I mean, I think they're there. You can get one for all, you know, like cell phones, cameras, DVDs, like things that exist in mass quantities. You're probably not going to get something like this to do that,
right?
Because we're not selling it at that level. The hope, though, is that as we start selling more, not just us, but others, that you'll see those prices start to come down. Modularity has a cost because you can't vertically integrate the entire thing to do one thing. But it goes back to my point, though, is that if, on the one hand, what you're trying to build for your daughter is a digital camera today, but a learning thing tomorrow and potentially something else down the road, I'm not saying you would use ours, but that factors into your thought into what you want to pay for the value of that. Right.
And that's why the Lego has value to me. I don't glue it together when I'm done building something. It comes apart and it becomes the next.
So I think that's how we look at it. And again, I want to emphasize, we're not trying to say this is the only way or this is the best way. It is just another way. And it's a way that doesn't currently exist in the market. Yeah.
So I find this much easier to understand the more sort of concrete examples you give. And throwing out the pothole detector in Kenya for me was a great example of something worth doing.
Yep.
But extremely hard to imagine a consumer electronics company
yep.
ever doing. Do you have good examples of people sort of hacking the hardware and making that to the released for sale in a store product cycle?
Not currently for sale, no. But we have plenty of people hacking applications together and making them available for free. So the most recent one was something I will never forget because it was I was at CES and a guy took his bug, and this is something we'd never done before. He ported Asterisk to it. Asterisk is an open source PBX. Ported a SIP client, which is an open source way of making phone calls, and he called me on my cell phone from his bug. It was the first time that's ever happened.
Yep.
So, again, not that you would buy a bug to become a phone.
Right.
It's very much a hacker, like, hey, I did this. But all that code is now, you know, you can download it and just do it. So a lot of stuff like that's happening. We have a couple examples of people building modules and putting them up, showing them on YouTube is what we've done, but no one's taken the next step of productizing it. We'd love if that happens. I think you'll see it probably this year.
Yeah.
People actually getting involved. And surprisingly, it's probably not going to come from an individual. I think we're going to see, you know, we did our Pico projector, which is a little tiny projector module, in concert with TI. TI has taken an enormous interest in open source hardware, not just us, but open source hardware as a movement. And so it's not inconceivable that, you know, companies like that will see the value of putting a module into our ecosystem. Only if they just want to see what happens, you know. For them, they have these. Here's a good example. I was at the Sensor Conference in Chicago last year, and it was this little niche little conference. And you go up to the sensor manufacturers like Freescale or others, and they assume that when you walk up to the booth, you're either from the automotive world, aerospace, or the military. I show up with this little thing. They're like, "Who are you, and why are you here? You make no sense to me." It was, you know what? Hey, you know, analog devices. You guys are coming out with a new Dead Reckoning chip. Now, for them, Dead Reckoning is good for submarines, you know, other kinds of heavy applications. So what if you spent $30,000 or $40,000 and we put together a module and we just sort of throw it into our ecosystem of, you know, a few thousand hackers and just see what they do with this thing? Maybe they'll come out with a new application for something you hadn't ever thought of. And for them, what's interesting about that for them is like, oh, that's great, easy. Because they don't have to design the whole system, they don't have to design the SDK, they don't have to do anything. So here's this little investment. Who cares? They get some brand equity out of participating in this new movement, and suddenly I get this new module that I can sell. I may even give them the revenue for it. I don't really care. But you're gonna, I think you're gonna start seeing stuff like that, because the sensor manufacturers are faced with that same problem, which is, what's the next killer app for the sensor? Well, if the military spending is going down, if the automotive industry is in the toilet, where do I look? You know, so. Yeah.
Hi. Are you connected with other open hardware initiatives, like people that do the Eiffel camera or the Arduino? Are there initiatives to
sure.
be connected together? And the second main question is, who are your competitors?
So the first question is, yes, we have. There's nothing formal. I mean, there's nothing formal about these alliances. But if you go to our website, you'll see there's lots of Arduino bug mashups. If you search for Arduino, almost always we're mentioned simultaneously, because we are sort of different sides of the same coin. If you really like working with solid-state electronics and that level, Arduino is fantastic. If you want to get into heavier duty things, like you want a full file system and network connectivity, not just yeah. we're good at that. So yes, and so you know Massimo and I, we know each other, but so yes, and the other ones like Chumbi, you know, we know of each other. I don't know if there's a lot of cross-pollination going on there. You know, we could probably name on two hands the open source hardware projects that are going on right now.
Okay.
Not too many of us. So yes.
And the competitor?
Our competitors, our biggest competitor is inertia. Our biggest competitor is incredulity. Like, I can do what? One of the things that I was talking about yesterday with somebody is, you know, when the microcomputer came out, it was, you say, go back to 1976, Apple was founded. You know, at the time, there was probably 20, 30, 50 other microcomputer.
Yes,
right. All beating each other up, getting people's imagination going, right?
And they are not here now. So the question is, in the future, I asked Massimo for Arduino. They own one thing, the Arduino people. They own the brand.
The
Arduino, the name.
Yep.
So I asked Massimo if what prevents him to make his open source project as a non-open source project. Also, you're talking about the military. Eiffel people, they went to lots of conferences in the US to try to now in a way, sell the project to more military application. If I am a hardware hacker, to be a test bed for military innovation, assimilation, and creativity, externalization of the army, maybe I will not be happy that you use me to give idea for the military, first for free, first maybe with not my ethical agreement. So is what prevents me as a hacker of knowing that in 10 years your company will not be open source anymore, that you will be in the business and use me for externalizing innovation?
Well, a lot of questions in that one. I think that, well, the best thing about open source really is that you're a little bit protected if I go out of business, because mm-hmm. the open source is out there. Copyright is the copyright for the code. I can't retroactively go back and change the copyrights out there. So,
okay, for the code, okay.
So that's the benefit. Hardware, the same thing. All of our schematics, like, so right now, our schematics, our Gerber files, our bombs, everything you need to go and build exactly what we have, you can take it and go to Korea or Singapore or whatever. You can build it exactly right now. We give it all to you. No one's doing it right now because, you know, we're not making a good bazillion dollars and they say, oh, we're going to knock that off. But it's not impossible. But if I were to go to business tomorrow, that IP would still be out there, right?
Yes.
So you could go and say, hey, that's a great idea. I'm going to pick up where they left off. And, you know. So there's a little bit of investment protection in that respect. With respect to somehow ensuring that the stuff you give to the community is not used for some nefarious purpose, I don't think there is any way you can do that. I mean, Linux, as far as I know, Al-Qaeda uses Linux. You know, you can't, And, you know, we've had many discussions with the military, the CIA, the Department of Defense, because they love this idea of quickly modifying something in the field, right? But they are terrified of open source. Because their one line, which they cannot get over, is, well, if the enemy has all the schematics for our electronics, why is that a good thing? I'm like, it's not a good answer. I don't have a good answer.
They have the periodic table. What can they do?
Yeah.
They're getting there. Are they clone of bugs like Freeduino for Arduino? Are they free bug? Has it been replicated like Freeduino replicated Arduino?
Has there been people replicating the bug hardware?
Yeah.
I don't think so. The thing we have is different than
Arduino
is a very simple board.
Yes.
So it's not hard to go and have that made.
Yeah.
Ours is like a 12-layer monster. So you can go do it, but it's going to cost some money. That wasn't intentional, but just to get what we wanted done,
looks like a challenge now. Okay.
It, well, you could do it. It's just not, it's not going to be as simple as knocking off an arduino.
Thank you.
Yeah. What? Anybody who hasn't asked a question? Yeah.
So I used to work for Analog Devices.
Okay, good.
As you're doing engineering, first thing that happens when you find a cool idea is all these lawyers sticking on you.
Yeah.
You want to patent it before someone else patents it. Patent. How do you avoid, if everything's open and free, how do you avoid someone saying, hey, look at this cool community. You all developed before me. I'm going to go patent it. And then, you know.
Well, as soon as it's publicly discussed, you can't patent it.
Well, arguably, yes.
No, but as soon as it's publicly disclosed, you can't patent it. But I think a bigger issue is all this stuff happening, people recognizing and saying, hey, you know what, that looks a lot like the patent I own,
right,
and going and suing everybody, right? You're not going to stop that. That's Lord Schlesig is around here someplace, isn't he? I mean, if he was here, but I think that's just an issue we have as a society, that we got to decide whether or not that's okay. But right now, I pretty much tell my investors that if we're successful, we will be sued, period. I don't care if it's legitimate or not, we will get sued. We'll be told your copyright infringes left and right. It's just the cost of doing business right now. It's unfortunate. It's true.
You haven't hit that milestone yet?
No. I think there was some guy circling for a while. In fact, it's funny. One of the companies that ordered a bunch of bugs was, the shipping address was patents.org. Like, let's lose their order. But yeah, it'll happen. It hasn't happened yet, though.
So maybe we should take one more question before
we wrap up? Sure. Anybody?
I
could talk all
day.
So.
I have a little statement I'd like to say at the end, so I don't want to.
Any other questions? Yes.
So how would what you're offering compare to something like the gumstick processor? Like, what's the advantage that you?
I think, first of all, we love gumsticks. We have a bunch. We're a big customer of gumsticks, actually. It is, we're more of a complete package, meaning you can go from saying I want a motion detector audio server, to finish product, like actually having it very, very quickly, like a matter of minutes. You just say, okay, snap, download app, done. Gumsticks is more, you've got to be comfortable looking at PCBs and connecting things together and solid state electronics. That's pretty much the difference. Because we're more of an integrated thing. But you know, we're talking now about getting our stack running on Gumsticks hardware. There's, like, you know, there's also the Beagle board from TI, which is a OMAP-based little board, which is very popular. Of us saying, you know, our model is not around owning the hardware platform and saying you can only run your application on our stuff. In fact, one of the reasons we chose Java is this idea that you can run Java on lots of places. So any place you can run our framework, you can run the application. So it's not inconceivable that you've got a Beagle board, you know, Doc's got a Gumsticks, I've got a bug, and we're all sharing the same application.
Just to jump in, what's the what would be the advantages of organizing more the open source hardware community? So, for example, the European Union has a thematic network for the public domain, and we're participating, and they meet four times a year, and that'd be one form. And but what would you like to achieve there? I mean, what would be useful to achieve there?
Okay, so let's start with the end. The end would be, say, 10 years from now, I'm an entrepreneur, and I said, I have really a great idea for a device. In the same way that I say, I've got a great idea for a piece of software, I can go to like a SourceForge type of place, and I can say, it has these qualities. I want this type of form factor. I want this type of, you know, parameters. And it'll sort of spit out the different pieces and parts it has, whether it be schematics, bill of materials, whatever, that you can then use for free or under GPL to get where you want to go a lot faster than if you had to sort of go and hire Flextronics or IDEO to do it for you. Like, that's, it'd be a repository of open source IP for building electronics. That doesn't really exist today. I mean, it exists, you know, in not any sort of centralized place. Cool. Well, thank you guys very much. I appreciate this. I enjoyed it. So.
Well, thank you. Nice to see you.